You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll find out about a brand new Latin music festival right here in Wisconsin. First, when it comes to end-of-life care, more and more people these days are choosing home hospice care, sometimes opting for comfort over a possible cure. That means in many cases, opioid drugs are being brought into the home to ease the suffering of patients. But amidst the backdrop of a nationwide opioid crisis, there's a new problem emerging. Those drugs are sometimes being stolen, often at the hands of friends, family members, or even caregivers. Our next guest points out that hospices in many states have largely been exempt from crackdowns on opioid prescriptions because dying patients often require high doses of opioids. And because of a lack of oversight, some say it's too easy for these drugs to fall into the wrong hands. Melissa Bailey joins us now. She's a correspondent for Kaiser Health News, where she writes about aging and dying. Melissa, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, in your piece, you write that as more people die at home on hospice, some of the powerful addictive drugs that they're prescribed are sometimes ending up in the wrong hands. So when did the medical establishment and hospice centers start to realize that this was becoming a problem?
So there's no real good national data on this problem. No one is tracking it. All the groups I talk to, so they don't have information on how common this is. But just talking to hospice providers, they're saying that just in the last 5 years, there's really started to be a conversation that we need to address the theft of these medications, especially in the home setting, which is just so hard to monitor. And we don't know how common this is, but we do know that enrollment in hospice has been rising rapidly. About half of people who die in America are now in hospice care. And while sometimes you think of hospice as a place you go to die, most of the time hospice staff are actually coming to the home, a private home or assisted living or a nursing home. And we know that deaths from opioid overdoses are at an all-time high.
And in your piece, you tell some stories of how this is occurring in the homes and care of people who are in hospice. Really gut-wrenching stories. Could you tell us a little bit about what you learned about these stories?
Yeah, some of these cases involve hospice staff taking medications out of the home. One of them, a 95-year-old patient, had her painkillers go missing. So investigators actually installed a hidden camera in her kitchen, and they found that a personal care aide was actually stealing her hydrocodone pills, which are opiate painkillers, and replacing them with acetaminophen, which is the active ingredient in Tylenol. And the stories that really struck me most were with family members who were addicted to these opioids, were stealing the drugs from their mother or their loved one. And in one case that was out of Missouri, the woman who was dying, her daughter was stealing her medications, according to the hospice inspection report. And the son was trying to take care of his mother, and he ended up getting into a physical fight with the sister, and he's begging the hospice to take their mother into a nursing home to just escape the situation, which was so anxiety-provoking. And the woman, the patient who was dying, ended up vomiting because she was just so anxious about what was happening in her family.
Yeah, these are really hard stories to hear about. And it seems as though since this problem is new, it's hard for hospice centers to get a handle on it. Do we know about what is needed to stop this from happening?
So the hospice people that I spoke to said, you know, we don't want to stop sending these painkillers into the home. People are really sick. They're in a lot of pain. They're not out shopping for opioids that they don't need. So no one wants to shut off access to painkillers for people who are dying at home, who've chosen hospice instead of dying in a hospital. Hospices that I did talk to said they are already taking some steps. So they limit how many days of medication they send to the home. Usually it's about 2 weeks, but if they suspect there's theft, they might send just a few days medication into the home. They might use drugs like methadone that are harder to misuse because they don't get the high that morphine or other drugs include. And they might have a nurse who's in the home just count the pills every time they visit to try to keep track of this problem.
Is there more specific training that might be needed, or maybe oversight or regulation from that end?
There is not much oversight or regulation. Some of the experts I talk to call for just comprehensive screening of every family that enters hospice. So because this opioid epidemic is really affecting everyone, rich and poor, you can't make assumptions about who might be at risk for stealing medications. So they suggest screening all patients and all families for a history of drug misuse, and then writing up agreements about what the family's responsibility is and what happens if these medications go missing. So Virginia's Hospice Association is the first one that I know of who's really come up with guidelines and is urging its hospices to be more proactive about this issue.
We're talking to Melissa Bailey right now from Kaiser Health News, and she's talking with us about how hospice centers are grappling with the opioid crisis, where medications are being stolen sometimes. And Melissa, one scenario that you write about is a patient who's on hospice. They're prescribed some sort of opioid medication, and then they pass away. They die, but they don't. The medication that they haven't taken is left behind. That seems like a very particular problem about, you know, who disposes of it and how what happens to it after that patient dies. How are hospice centers looking at that problem?
So this is common for anyone who maybe you have surgery and you have a bunch of pills left over in your house. Or, you know, there are many people who have lots of opioids sitting around in the house. And the USDA actually says that after a person dies, the drugs belong to the patient's family. So hospice workers can't step in and say, you know, give me those drugs, I'll destroy them to make sure they aren't resold or used by the wrong person. So unless a state specifically passes a law to allow that. So in the past 3 years, the four states that I know of have passed laws that allow hospice workers to actually go in and destroy the medications. And Wisconsin has introduced a bill in July that would also allow hospice workers to take a more proactive role in destroying medications.
Is there a right way to destroy opioids after a loved one or a family member passes?
Yeah, they used to say flushing down the toilet, but the EPA is saying that that's not environmentally safe. So people suggest mixing them with kitty litter or coffee grounds so they can't be reused. Or if your loved one dies and you inherit their possessions, you have the right to take these drugs to a law enforcement center to a take-back program.
And because of this theft problem, is the burden on the hospice center themselves? Do they face fines or maybe charges because there isn't a strict protocol in place yet?
Some states have been citing hospices for not having written procedures in place to inform families about the risks of substance use and to, you know, here's what you have to do to dispose of medications after someone dies. But I haven't seen a lot of oversight or enforcement on this.
Now, it seems like hospices are in kind of a tough situation. On the one hand, they want to give terminally ill people the medication that they need to be comfortable and to alleviate pain. And on the other hand, bringing too many of these drugs into the home can lead to some of the problems we're talking about. And if you get too aggressive, screening family members for a history of drug use, maybe testing urine, I mean, that's a difficult place to be too. So how are hospices expected to strike a balance here?
Yeah, I think you're exactly hitting the difficulty of this issue. We don't want anyone who's dying in incredible pain with bed sores, with frail, broken bones because they're in their last weeks of life. We don't want them to be denied drugs that they need. But at the same time, it's a risk to the community that if people are taking these and dying of an overdose or bringing harm to themselves. So I think it's a challenge that hospice workers everywhere are confronting, and they're just now in the last few years starting to really talk about how to handle this.
Melissa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Melissa Bailey is a correspondent for Kaiser Health News, where she writes about aging and dying. And she joined us to talk about how hospice centers today are grappling with the opioid crisis and the problem of stolen medication. Coming up, a huge Latin music festival is happening for the first time this weekend near the Wisconsin Dells. We'll find out the story behind it. Stay with us on Central Time. This weekend marks the first ever Los Dells Latin Festival. The event is Saturday and Sunday and features a big range of Latin music, food, and art, and it's all happening in the Wisconsin Dells. Damon Zumwalt decided to launch Los Dells after growing up 10 miles from the U.S.-Mexican border and being steeped in Latin culture and music. Damon, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
And Enrique Chi is a singer and band leader of Making Movies, a band from Kansas City that's going to be playing at Los Dells. Enrique, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. We're super excited.
Damon, we're going to start with you before we talk to Enrique and listen to a little bit of music. How did you get the idea, Damon, to host a Latin music festival on the scale in Wisconsin?
Well, I just, I was raised for a good part of my life in San Diego, near the border. When I first started college, I was a Spanish major. A good number of my friends, my best friends were Mexicanos. And so I was deep into the culture of the Hispanic culture and loved the language, loved the people. And so I always felt that when I found this property, it was a great property. We have that we're building here on this 1,500-acre property. We have a big sports complex, but we also have concert fields. And it's just an unbelievable site. I think this area near the Dells is like the diamond in the rough. The rest of the country needs to know how beautiful this part of Wisconsin really is. It's incredible.
And, Damon, I heard that you saw the site for the first time, you thought, I want to put on a music festival there.
The first thing I thought was, how many soccer fields could I put down? And wouldn't this be a great place for a concert, too? Mm. So I love both sports and music. So my whole life has revolved around that for the last 50 years. So now I have the opportunity to execute on both.
And you're on site right now, right? You're watching stuff get built and put together?
I'm right here on the field where they're building a massive, massive stage. We have three stages, and stage one is like unbelievable. I think it's even bigger than ones, that have ever been built here before, so, in the state.
And Enrique...
But we have a great lineup, so we need it.
Enrique Chi, we're going to turn to you now. Can you tell us about how you and the rest of Making Movies got involved in this fest?
Well, we met, Damon, we haven't met you personally yet, but Elena, who you work with, is a friend of ours like 8 years ago. Our band's kind of, we're almost like a punk band in our ideology, where we got into a van and started touring really early on. Long before maybe anybody was asking us to come to the city, we just found a way to play anywhere, whether it was people's basements. And then one of those trips, we met Elena years ago. And fast forward to today, we put out a new album called I Am Another You, and it really is centered around the immigrant idea and the immigrant experience. I was born in Panama. My cousin was born in Venezuela, and our percussionist and drummer's family is from Mexico. But they've crossed the border both ways a couple of times in their lives, from Mexico to the U.S. and from the U.S. to Mexico. And so it just, like, has been a part of our family. We started making this record 3 years ago because of some record label stuff. We couldn't put it out. It kind of got delayed. And all of a sudden, we're sitting on this record that's about our family story, about the immigrant experience, and all of a sudden the political climate in the U.S. shifts. And this record that's really about my cousin and me and the way I felt as a human being and not really a political statement has evolved into having this kind of more political rhetoric and outlook. And the concept of I'm Another You is like we're all kind of all in this together. So it's kind of been a crazy trip. And we put out the record on our own label after kind of figuring out our business situation. So we made our own label to put it out, and we ended up charting on the Latin album chart, got to climb to number 3. Every other band on that was on major labels, on Universal, on Sony, and here we are, a little band on a record label, which is basically the desk in my living room, and been hustling this on our own, kind of, like I said, with that punk rock mentality, and now we're just so grateful to be getting these great and bigger opportunities to expose our work to the world.
Yeah, how would you describe your music? What is the style?
think we're like an immigrant punk band. I mean, that's not really, we're not like, punk is the wrong word a lot of times because it's not how the music sounds, but it's the attitude in it. It's just like we make the best with what we've got kind of attitude. I sometimes describe it as like if Santana had grown up in 2017, then maybe that's what he would sound like. You know, if he's mixing his culture and the New York salsa music where he's covering Tito Puente and all this stuff and mixing it all together with the psychedelic 60s culture. That's kind of like a more general way to describe what we do.
And we're listening to a little bit right now from your NPR Tiny Desk concert, which I had a lot of fun. I loved watching some of this afternoon while I was getting ready. And I want to ask you a little bit more about the political spirit. You said this was kind of something that blew up because of the cultural climate. Are you okay with your album having kind of a political angle now?
You know, I struggled with that, I would say, 5 years ago as a band. You starting a band, and I would feel a little hesitant, like, well, we're just a band. Why, just by being Latinos, does everything have to be political? And I would have some resistance to it. We had this amazing opportunity this year to be the artist in residence at the Folk Alliance Conference. It's like an international music conference. And we performed right before Billy Bragg. We were asked to create a bed of music for a police officer who's Latino, who had written this poem that the poet laureate had read. And he wrote this poem about being conflicted, about being a police officer. We made music to it. And then Billy Bragg got up to speak. And I don't know if you know Billy Bragg, but he's a very political songwriter from the UK. And he, before he got on stage, he went to us and he's like, man, that fired me up. Thank you so much for doing what you did. I was like, oh, wow, cool compliment. He gives this speech. He talks about Pete Seeger passing down the torch to him and says in his speech, he's like, you know, there's a moment where Pete Seeger says, it's your turn. You have to write the songs for your people. It's your turn to speak for the voice of your community. And so he gets off stage, and I kind of, you know, echo back to him, wow, you really fired me up. And then he looked at me dead in the eyes, and he goes, you know, it's your turn now. You have to write songs for your people. And then Nora Guthrie walked in backstage, because she was there, because she's friends with Billy Bragg. She'd asked Billy Bragg to cover Woody Guthrie songs. She turned to me, saw me, and she goes, wow, that was amazing. This should be on national television. This is the kind of message people need. And she looked at me and she goes, and now it's your turn. It's your turn to write the songs for your people.
Message is coming strong.
Yeah, so I was like, well, I guess I don't have a choice anymore. So I think at that moment, I realized that, you know, any ideology, like this, it's a simple ideology that I think most people can get behind it, regardless of your color or where you come from. You have to accept that the human experience comes from migration. Even if you're Native American, it comes from the migration through the, you know, through a lot of different methods from Asia. And there's DNA links to all this history. And everything we have, even a guitar, is a Middle Eastern instrument that was passed down through all kinds of cultures before we get to the Martin Dreadnought in New York City. And everything we have is a result of that. That's an ideology. It's a belief based on facts, but it's still kind of a philosophy. But the second you take the philosophy out of the kind of intangible realm and try to implement it into the real world, it becomes political. But I'm willing to fight for the ideology that we are all a part of this great human experience, and no one deserves more from it than anyone else. I think that's what standing up for.
We're talking to Enrique Chi right now, singer and band leader of Making Movies, a band from Kansas City that's going to be playing this upcoming weekend at Los Dells. And Damon Zumwalt is with us. He decided to launch the Latin Music Festival Los Dells after growing up 10 miles from the U.S.-Mexican border and being steeped in Latin culture and music. And Damon, let's go back to you. Tell us a little bit about, besides Making Movies, who else can audiences see?
Oh, my goodness. And of course, you know, the largest band in the Hispanic or Spanish-speaking world is Maná. And Maná is Closer on Wood Night, Daddy Yankee, Nicky Jam, Los Tucanes de Tijuana, Becky G, Reek, Weeson. I mean, it just goes on and on. We have over 25 different bands, and, you know, they're the top names in the entire world. In the Hispanic-speaking world right now are signed up, and the only ones that aren't are the ones we're looking to save for signing in the second year.
And
but
I want
to still have to have something. You have to have something left over for year number two.
You mentioned the Mexican band Maná, and here's a little bit from them. Bit from the band Maná, which will be appearing at Los Dells, and you mentioned Yankee Daddy, and they've been part of the collaboration that produced the crossover hit Despacito, right?
Yeah, Daddy Yankee.
Daddy Yankee. Sorry, I flipped it around. Daddy Yankee. Tell me about that link
he
there.
He might be a Yankee Daddy too.
So, what can people expect from that band this weekend?
Oh my goodness! You know this, you know, like he was talking about before. You know, music is the one thing that ties the world together better than probably anything else in history, is bringing the world closer together. And so we have a variety of different genres, whether it's, you know, whether it's the reggaeton from the guys down from Puerto Rico, or typical Mexican music, or machata with Prince Royce is also going to be here. You know, so this is something that is going to be a great taste for everyone's palate. You know, they're going to get an opportunity in one place to see more bands than you can see in a lifetime.
Well, it sounds fantastic. Thank you both for joining us. Enrique, appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having us. We're really excited to come there. And Damien, I hope we get to hang out a little bit. We'll be there both Saturday and Sunday.
Looking forward to seeing you on my great property here.
All right, and Damon.
Welcome to Wisconsin.
And Damon, thanks to you. Good luck this weekend.
Thank you very much.
That was Damon Zumwalt. He decided to launch Los Dells after growing up just 10 miles from the U.S.-Mexican border. And that festival is going to be going on this weekend. And thank you to Enrique Chi, singer and bandleader of Making Movies, a Kansas City band that will be playing at Los Dells. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. No sé si viste la última noticia que el mundo se va a acabar. Y esta vez no es mentira. Si vamos, la línea se cortó. No creerá lo que yo he visto. No es un tranque, sino una pesadilla. Y todos unidos bailan. Texas continues to be pummeled by Tropical Storm Harvey. Much of the nation's attention has turned to the presidential response to the ongoing disaster in that state. President Trump is visiting Texas today with stops in Corpus Christi and Austin. He also addressed the ongoing federal response to the disaster during a news conference yesterday.
Recovery will be a long and difficult road, and the federal government stands ready, willing, and able to support that effort. Right now, the single most important thing is the safety and security of those still in harm's way.
Hurricane Harvey is the first major test of Trump's leadership since taking office earlier this year, and federal responses to natural disasters can weigh heavily on a presidency. Charles Franklin joins us now. He's a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School Poll. He's also the co-founder of Pollster.com and the founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, thanks a lot for being here.
Glad to be here.
Well, for any sitting president, how much is riding on their response to a major national disaster?
A fair bit, maybe not quite as much as folklore would have. But if you think about Hurricane Katrina and President Bush and the difficulties that came in recovery there, or think about Sandy, which hit just before the 2012 election on the New Jersey and the East Coast. Those were two large storm events with somewhat different perceptions. Obama mostly got credit for the response to Sandy, and Bush mostly got blame for Katrina. I think the one qualification there is that a lot of the immediate aftermath of a storm rests with state and local officials. The federal role really comes a bit later in its biggest component. And so, to some extent, the president may get blame or credit for how well local and state officials respond.
So as part of the beginning part where the federal role may not be as large, is part of the biggest job for the president to make sure that they're looking the role of commander-in-chief, they're being supportive, they're saying the right things, and they're not, I don't know, kicking back on a beach, sipping, you know, mixed drinks, but they're involved and they're engaged.
Exactly. And I think the being a bit of a cheerleader, being a bit of a consoler-in-chief, showing that the federal government and in that sense, the country as a whole stands behind the people who are victims of the disaster are all part of the role of the president. I think it's important to realize in the case of President Bush that he didn't ignore Katrina. In fact, one of the things he gets blamed for is a picture of him looking out the window of a plane as they went over the disaster. In a different context, you might have thought that showed concern that he took a flight down there so he could see firsthand what was happening. Instead, that image became one of him somehow being disconnected from the process. So a lot of what happens is in the way it gets framed. Now, President Bush also had the misfortune of saying to his FEMA directors, Federal Energy Management, or Federal Emergency Management Administrator, you're doing a heck of a job, Brownie, at a time when it was clear that recovery was not going well. And I think that image ultimately probably had more of an impact on President Bush's reputation for dealing with that, more so than the flight over, though the flight over now is sort of the thing we recognize and point to.
And that said, how much do the actions of FEMA or other groups reflect on the president, the work that they're doing on the ground, even though the president isn't directly involved?
I think the responsibility for the management reflects on the president and his administration and his choice of leadership in that agency. President Trump has only been in office for, what, 7 going on 8 months now. Whether FEMA is prepared or not is much more dependent on how the Bush administration responded to Katrina and how the Obama administration responded post-Katrina and post-Sandy. The agency certainly has not been made over in the last 8 months. And I think those lessons from Katrina and Sandy undoubtedly make the agency better prepared to deal with the aftermath of Harvey now.
What do you think the lessons are, at least the political lessons?
Well, I think part of it is show concern, show a robust response. It's worth realizing that in Katrina, part of the problem was that, first of all, the geography of New Orleans is that it's sort of a bowl, and so when it fills up with water, it really doesn't drain very well. So we had a prolonged period of flooding there. But more importantly, we saw people trapped on rooftops for a long time before they were reached. We saw people in the Superdome not getting food and water. It was a horrible condition. Those are the things I was saying are more a function of the state and local response than of the federal response. But the federal response comes in providing temporary housing for displaced people, providing financial support for rebuilding, providing the infrastructure support for roads that may be impassable for a long time. Those are things that are much longer term. I think we'll see the imagery right now of rescues or people trapped, but that's not so much FEMA. FEMA are going to be acres and acres and acres of temporary housing, and we won't see that for some time to come.
We're talking right now with political scientist Charles Franklin about the ongoing response to Tropical Storm Harvey in Texas and beyond, as well as the impact a natural disaster can have on any presidency. And today, President Trump is in Texas, and he's being briefed on the relief efforts. He's meeting with local leaders, even while it's raining and the storm, it's still an active situation. And this seems like, you know, kind of a tough position for a president. On the one hand, the president wants to show concern, as you said, On the other hand, you've got a presidential visit in the midst of an unfolding disaster, which could cause, you know, people on the ground to divert attention from where it's really needed. It's a big deal when a president goes anywhere. Is this something that's difficult for presidents to do, to strike a balance?
It is, and it's very much a delicate political position to be in. From the accounts I've read of the president's visit today, he met with some state leaders, though my understanding is he did not meet with the Houston mayor, which may make sense. The Houston mayor probably should be spending his time in Houston rather than going off to Corpus Christi to meet with the president. And so the show of concern was there. They stayed away from Houston, so he wasn't actually in the immediate disaster zone, possibly taking away resources. But as I say, President Bush also visited New Orleans actually several times, and in showing concern may have sent one message, but in seeming to be out of touch with the difficulty of recovery sent a very different message. President Obama went to New Jersey, famously got hugged by Chris Christie while he was there, promised a response, promised federal aid, and in general escaped some of the blame for slow recovery that President Bush suffered from. I think the real issue with President Trump is going to be whether he can resist claiming to have solved the problems when those problems are clearly not resolved, say in a week or a month from now. We really don't know how long it's going to take for Houston to start to look like a semblance of its usual self. And whether the president seems in touch with those difficulties or seems to send a message that things are better than they are, that's the question of whether he falls into the trap that I think President Bush fell into.
Now, President Trump has one different element at play here. He loves Twitter, and he's very active on Twitter. And during the hurricane, he's had some tweets related to the hurricane. Some tweets, you know, one was a book recommendation, criticism of NAFTA, another tweet. Is that kind of social media response uncharted territory for presidents?
Well, it certainly is uncharted territory. Obama used Twitter a bit, but in a much more scripted presidential way, if you will. President Trump, for better or for worse, reveals a lot more of what he's thinking through what he says on Twitter, both for the good and for the bad for his image or his policies. I think you've seen him commenting on how big this storm is, which is absolutely correct. This is by far a record-setting rainfall for Houston. But he's also saying, you know, people are doing a great job down there. And in terms of citizens volunteering for rescues, that seems absolutely appropriate. But as I say, we're still some time away from knowing how well the recovery operation is going, how well we're doing with managing the problems of the flooding and the aftermath. So I think we're still a few days away from beginning to get a sense of whether the president's overselling the response or perhaps presenting it appropriately.
Charles Franklin is right now. He's a political scientist, and we're talking about the ongoing federal response to Tropical Storm Harvey in Texas and also looking at the impact that a natural disaster like a hurricane can have on a presidency. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. What kind of response from the president and the federal government do we need to see, do you think, after a natural disaster? And what's the best thing our policymakers can do to help people affected? How would you rate President Trump's response to Hurricane Harvey so far? And what questions do you have? Well, you can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation with political scientist Charles Franklin about the ongoing federal response to Hurricane Harvey in Texas and beyond. And we're talking about how a good or bad federal response to a natural disaster can affect a president's legacy. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What are you watching for when it comes to a federal response to a natural disaster? How can policymakers best help people in need? And do you think Congress will be able to get the job done when it comes to passing funding for disaster relief? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Charles, the White House and Congress will now have to find a way to approve billions of dollars in recovery funds eventually, even though they haven't agreed on a lot this year. How do you see this playing out in the coming weeks?
I would expect the president to back a substantial hurricane relief funding. We certainly spent a great deal of money after Katrina and after Sandy. Sandy relief was a bit controversial, as mostly Republican and actually mostly Texas members voted against the funding, saying that it contained too much pork barrel spending rather than hurricane relief. So there's a little bit of a political testiness there that now the relief will go for Texas. But I think the sense of the Congress and the president will be to fund that. This does come at a time when we're also going to be debating the budget for next year and the debt ceiling increase. So in that sense, it's a time to be spending a lot of money, but in the midst of conflicts over other federal budget priorities. But having said all of that, the country has a history of providing relief in the case of national disasters, and I'm sure we'll do that again.
Do you think that in general, providing disaster relief is something that's not a partisan issue, that it's not politicized, something that both sides can work together on? Is that true, or has that changed? We've been seeing some headlines in the paper about the maybe political response to aid after Hurricane Sandy.
I think that's maybe a little more politicized, but in the case of Sandy, the opponents consistently made the point that they were concerned about the implications of the deficit, and that the funding was not being taken from other programs. I think that would be the real issue this time, is whether anyone wants to argue that they're in favor of disaster relief, but only if it's paid for by taking the money from other programs. In the end, I'd be very surprised if we don't see a substantial amount of money dedicated to relief of the hurricane damage. There are also side issues for things like flood insurance and construction standards, and those things can be fairly partisan and subject to a lot of debate about how much the federal government should be specifying things like whether you can build in a flood zone and whether federal flood relief, flood insurance can be available for that. Those are issues that have actually been debated a fair bit over the last few years, and the aftermath of Harvey will simply bring those back to the table as well.
How do you expect the government to start to answer those questions? We're living in an era where climate is more, it seems, unpredictable, and it might be hard, you know, if you're on a 100-year floodplain, what does that mean now?
Well, this has been a substantial debate, and in fact, in some of the regulations that the Trump administration has been rolling back from Obama are things like construction standards that either anticipate rises in sea level, which the Obama administration put in place, or whether we don't have those. And as I understand it, those regulations have just recently been pulled back by the Trump administration. So, and also the issues of whether providing flood insurance to people who build in flood zones and then suffer losses and then rebuild in those flood zones. Those are important political debates to have about whether it's sensible policy or not. But we had those debates during the Obama administration. We're now having them in the Trump administration. And the aftermath of Harvey will just, I think, demonstrate the relevance of those kinds of regulatory issues when you live, when you have a massive city and a very important economic region located in a hurricane zone and fairly low-lying land.
Now, we were talking earlier about President Trump's visit to Texas today. What do you think, based on what you've seen so far, is the president on the ground in Texas giving residents in Texas and people who are looking for leadership from a commander-in-chief, is he giving them what they want to see?
I think in some ways it's a little early to say. I've only seen some of the coverage of what he said and done today. But this is a symbolic demonstration of concern. Any decisions that he's made on this trip are things that certainly the president could have made from the White House and being in communication with people on the ground. The same can be said for Obama going to Hurricane Sandy's aftermath. He could have been informed of that. So these are symbolic visits intended to show concern and involvement in the government response. And to the extent that people are comforted by those visits or see them as a positive indication of support, then I suppose that's a good thing for the public. But it's in crafting the longer-term response that we'll really see how substantive funding is and other kinds of policy decisions for what to do in the aftermath.
Charles Franklin is with us right now, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School Poll, as we talk about Hurricane Harvey and the presidential response and the federal response. And Charles, you're a polls guy, and you looked at what happened with President Bush and the impact. As you said, he did get a lot of blame, some criticism for some missteps in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. But did he end up taking a big hit for that in terms of his poll numbers?
Right. Not a big hit in the way that people often think of big hits. During the year leading up to Katrina, President Bush had been falling in approval very steadily at about 1% a month. He had come into January a little over 50%. He ended October at about 39%. So he had fallen 12 or 13 points over that period. But he did take more of a hit during Katrina than a normal month would have hurt him given that trend. The actual decline was just 1.4 percentage points, but that was as much as he was losing in about a month and a half before Katrina. And so there was an impact, but you'd have to be a polling geek to kind of appreciate that 1.4 points is actually a pretty big hit to a presidential approval when it happens practically overnight, as it did with Katrina.
As a polling geek yourself, did that surprise you that it wasn't, I mean, even more precipitous than it was? 1.4, you say, is kind of significant when you look at the trends over a month, but would you have expected worse?
I think the popular imagination is it would have been a much bigger hit because he did take a lot of blame and a lot of negative publicity for it. I think it's simply from a polling point of view to realize that presidential approval moves fairly slowly. We very rarely see someone truly in free fall, falling at 3 or 4 or 5 percentage points a month. President Nixon during Watergate fell at about 4% a month. And so from that perspective, a big event like Katrina can hurt a president, but generally has not devastated them. On the other hand, bad events, weather events, actually some evidence from shark attacks, believe it or not, have been shown to have some impact on presidential support. And those are things that it's maybe more the president's response to that matters rather than the event itself.
And the event, of course, still unfolding, heartbreaking to watch and also inspiring at times. We're all hoping for the best for Texas and hoping for the best going forward. Charles, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School Poll, also co-founder of Pollster.com. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, there have been calls for loneliness to be treated as a public health concern. We'll talk with a social psychologist about what loneliness does to us and how to address it. That plus a look at the news of the day tomorrow on Central Time. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardin Show. Tomorrow after 7, Joy gets different perspectives on the departure of Wisconsin's DNR Secretary, Kathy Stepp, for a post with the EPA. That's coming up tomorrow morning after 7 on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll get the details of yesterday's budget committee meeting on education. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is Central Time.